Hello, and welcome to another episode of the New Academy Series podcast, a monthly series wherein we talk with non-tenure-track faculty members in English about their professional lives in an effort to help understand and legitimize the ever-expanding adjunct pool that is the profession. I'm Dave Morris.
And I'm Mary Lucille Hayes. Our guest today is Dana Kinsey, lecturer in English. Most of us know Dana as the Associate Director of Rhetoric and as a nearly bottomless source of pedagogical support and wisdom in teaching our comp courses. She has a PhD in writing studies from Nebraska at Lincoln and an MFA in poetry from the University of West Virginia. Today we'll talk with her about her creative writing work.
Thanks for being here, Dana.
Thanks for having me.
Hooray. So our first question today gets right at your poems, and they seem to me to take on a variety of topics, ranging from family and love relationships to moments of rupture and trauma to frustrations and joys with the limitations and opportunities of language. It seems like a recurring interest across your poems is attempts to expose and remove walls and barriers that work themselves into the mundane processes of everyday life, barriers between people, between high theory and art production, between speaking and receiving. Where does this interest come from? Is it a long time interest or something that came upon you quickly in particular moments?
Well, there's a line from this Dan Byrne song that says something like, if you have to put me in a box, make sure it's a big box with lots of windows and a nice high ceiling and a door to walk through. And I sometimes feel like that's the story of my life. I had an early experience in second grade that was a negative experience. And then lots of other positive experiences. But the second grade experience, I attended a parent-teacher conference with my mom and remembered hearing my teacher tell my mom that she shouldn't expect much out of me in life, which was like excruciating. And like in my memory of this thing that happened, I remember having like an initial like absolutely not reaction, like I will show you. And also what's the point of saying something like that kind of reaction. And as things in my life have unfolded, I've come to like look at things as like, well, what's the purpose of anything? Like we all should be striving to be like our best selves, pushing our edges and learning and trying to be better people. And we all should be like striving to forge connections with other people. And so in other experiences, I've often found myself asking like, well, if there's a system in place, is it a system that's designed to make better connections between people and help us be our best selves? Or is it a system that's designed to keep us apart and limit us? And if it's one of those limiting, separating kind of systems, then we should throw everything we have at changing it. And if it's a system that's about connection and people striving to be their best selves, then it's a good system and we should keep it. And so those become like themes that come up a lot in both my creative and my scholarly work.
Well, I can, having worked with you for the past year doing tutorials in your class, I can see how that perfectly dovetails with your scholarly work, because everything you just said, I can see how that formative experience has helped you in a really positive way in the way that you interact with your students.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I also really recognize in what you're saying that this kind of tension that I think we see in a lot of the people we know in various places between recognizing a problematic system and wanting to change it, and at the same time having this little edge like, I'll show you.
Yeah.
like I can do this better than you think I can, and I find that strangely reassuring.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a streak of stubbornness there. I mean, I might be nice, but I'm also like, yeah.
Right.
Right. And I see that streak of stubbornness in the way that you work with your students. Like, you really are rooting for them to show that they can do it too, whatever their barriers or challenges are. So, yeah.
And part of what we're doing in teaching is trying to get them to direct their stubbornness in the right direction.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Right.
Like, what kind of stories are they telling themselves about who they can be? And I want them to believe in that vision of the best self.
And it's funny how in our different students that plays out differently, whether it's about encouraging them to sort of show us what they can do, or just getting them to slow down and recognize that all of their efforts are aimed toward things that maybe are a little bit strange, like debating us over minor point differences and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Though, as somebody who was kind of the queen of creatively reinterpreting assignments as a student, like, I have a lot of admiration and respect for, like, their willingness to push on the edges of things. So I maintain a good sense of humor, even when sometimes it's like, why this conversation again? But
funny. So do you feel like your creative writing work is influenced by your writing studies work and the other way around? Does one sort of come first for you?
I don't think I would say one comes first. But there is a lot of influence back and forth. I believe really strongly that the best teachers of writing are writers themselves. You might hear in that I came through a National Writing Project site, which, like, it's part of their mission. And so in Nebraska, I both facilitated and attended some of those sessions. And so I think it's easier for me to speak to my students' struggles with writing anxiety and writer's block and how frustrating the writing process can be, because I go through those things myself. I also get energized from talking about writing and interacting with new people constantly, and can take that back to my creative work. So I think that they're really entwined and continue to feed each other, and both really are, like, related to the sense that narrative is super important to us as human beings. And so helping my students engage with narrative.
And so thinking about teaching academic writing as also self-narration.
Absolutely.
Rather than as strange independent exercises in finding things and regurgitating them.
Exactly. Like, they will leave the academy, most of them, and go on and have to present ideas they have to a variety of audiences, and talking to them about that, making them conscious of that, I think can only help them in life.
I'm pretty sure when I read your poem After the Amputation, I'm pretty sure you've used that in teaching.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes. I use that a lot in teaching, and when I finish writing the chapter for the rhetoric textbook on revision, I will include the various versions of that poem in there. It's a way that I have modeled what my writing process looks like for my students, and I really want students to walk away from my class with a sense that revision isn't just last minute editing, but is
a spelling correction.
Yeah, is a way to re-see things. And the poem After the Amputation started by me writing about a story where I had been asked to cat sit for a friend right after their cat had gotten caught in an illegal animal trap had to have his leg amputated. And in this story, the cat, this is a true story, unfortunately, the cat woke me by peeing on my head in protest, which, I think I would protest strongly
them.
Too. Yes, I have great empathy for this cat.
Yeah.
But the initial version of the poem was really it was a self-deprecating story, just relating what had happened. And over the drafts, I discovered what my purpose was and realized that, because I kept coming back, it took me 7 years to write this poem, and I kept coming back to it. And if something is pulling you in that much, there's something there. Like, Like, why am I meditating on this? Why does it keep coming up? And over time realized that the poem really wanted to be about grief, and what it means to grieve and how this animal made me contemplate my own losses in life. Not so profound necessarily as what the cat had suffered, but it was a way to self-reflect. And so I can talk to my students about how sometimes through writing and reflecting, you realize that you have something more to say than you initially thought.
I love that it took you 7 years to write that poem.
Yeah.
And I love that you share that with your student. You tell them about that too.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because, the way our classes are structured, they have deadlines that are, you know, come up pretty fast, and then they think they're done with it. And so that's, I think that's really important. And I do want to talk about the work too, but I also want to hear about your writing process. But first I wanted to ask you, it seemed to me like there's a lot of elemental stuff in your poems. Like I noticed in several of them, there's a lot of birds, there's a lot of flight and rising and floating up, whether it's a bird or an inanimate object, like a kite or a balloon. And there's also a lot of starkness. There's just some really stark images that, you know, that you're not shying away from. You're not shying away from things. So, I don't know. Is that a question?
Yeah. I mean, I think for me, the best poems, like, look at life in a way that isn't afraid to recognize that there can be a harshness to life, but that there is also always, often at the same time, beauty. One of my favorite books of poetry, which is now a little, it's an older book. When I first encountered it, it was a new book. So as Judy Jordan's Carolina Ghostwoods. And I remember thinking that the poems in it were like spells or curses or chants, like they had this really like primal quality to them. So I can see myself striving for that kind of thing. And I think the uplift, like, I feel like it's a goal to try to be an irrepressible positive force, even in a world that wants to repress the positive. And so I could see that could be a key sort of metaphor that would be informing my work.
I think one of the things I've always enjoyed about you as a person is, even though you and I have vastly different styles and experiences, we both have this very, it's very Calvinist, this sort of look at this horrible, depraved world and recognizing these things to pull out of it, these things to build on, these sort of, that terribleness gives you a kind of duty to do those kinds of things. But to what extent that's Calvinist is a different kind of weird podcast. But I did want to ask, and this follows up on exactly what Mary just asked, where does the love of animals come from? There's just animals everywhere.
And
everyone who knows you love cats.
Yes.
But there's also birds and a variety of other things.
And they're not just in the poem.
Yep.
They're sometimes embodied in the speaker. I mean, like physically merged with the speaker.
Yes.
Yeah.
So.
I mean, I adore animals. I don't think, I mean, I'm not so keen on rats. And snakes are interesting to watch and think about, but I wouldn't ever keep one, probably. But I think I have like two memories from around age three, and one of them is we had a dog whose name was Hee-Haw, which makes sense given where I grew up. And my mom woke me up in the middle of the night. I was, you know, small. And took me into the basement where Hee-Haw was giving birth, and like seeing these puppies be born, and like holding them, like was a key moment for me. my paternal grandparents also had a farm, and so there were lots of animals there, always barn cats. And so I was pretty well known for carrying around a cat with me at all time. I also grossed everybody out by kissing a baby pig that had been brought into the house as a runt, asked if I could take it home. So I think it's been part of who I am. I have a niece now, her name is Ruby, and she is a lot like me. And my brother has a farm now, and she likes to sing to the cows while she helps milk them. Aww. And I vowed that I should only drink milk that comes from cows that are being sung to by sweet little girls. So, so I think it's just, I've had rich, interesting relationships with pets. And
there's a, like you said, Mary, kind of an identification with animals that comes through in your poetry.
I feel like animals, like, we don't always talk about how they have an essence, and we can have meaningful friendships with them. My cat, I don't think I would have made it through grad school without my cat Jake Bean. And he would sit on my desk when I would write and met me at the door every day of his life. It's a rich source of joy.
I wanted to talk a little bit, I guess, about form. And I was just really enjoying, I was reading these aloud, and I was really enjoying the S's in the smoking section. There were just so many, and they were just so, I don't know, smooth.
That's funny.
Yeah. So I guess I wonder, how much do you think about, obviously you're a poet, you think about the sounds of words and how they sound and stuff like that. It was just really fun to read that and thinking about how that goes along with this smoke kind of rising imagery.
Did it start as an S project?
It did not start as an S project. I don't even remember.
Oh my gosh.
What prompted that particular poem. Uh-huh. But I've had a struggle as one of my MFA teachers would talk about how there are music poets and there are story poets. And this professor said you had to be one or the other, but I thought I was both.
Yeah, I think you're both too.
I've had to tone it down a little bit because initially I would have these poems that were aggressively musical while also trying to tell a story. And so I think some of that was trying to tone down. But if you're going to write about smoking, there is a waftiness.
Yeah, yeah.
So it makes sense that that would be the music of that particular poem.
Yeah.
But I became an English major in college because of the music of poetry, because I had this Miss Erb, my high school English teacher, and her reading of Edgar Allan Poe's The Bells. And I just remember her going into raptures at the front of the classroom, just listen to it, hear it, the tintinnabulation of the bells, and being so enchanted, and her enthusiasm pulled me in. And so some of that obsession, and I went through a serious Edgar Allan Poe and then bleeding into Sylvia Plath stage when I was in late high school, early college, which I think is fairly standard.
Yeah.
But so some of that probably still shows up in the music.
That idea of the musical versus the storytelling just made me think of two halves of Paul Simon's career, but that's
good.
when I read the bio that you wrote for us, and we posted on the website already, correct?
Yes.
And we can post on Facebook too. The line I like the most is you referred yourself something like a vigilante subverting toxic narratives I think it was, that was it, right? And I thought, yeah, that's pretty accurate, actually. what I was wondering is, to what extent working here as an NTT or as Associate Director of Rhetoric gives you any opportunities to pursue that vigilante mission?
Well, I'm glad to hear somebody says that you think that could be true, because that's the end goal. Yeah. Honestly, I think all NTTs are vigilantes subverting toxic narratives. Like, one toxic narrative is this idea that as an academic, there's only like one version of what a successful career looks like. Mm-hmm. And I think that is fundamentally not true, and is incredibly damaging, and blinds us to the richness of the teaching, researching, writing community that we're a part of. And so I would say every NTT is like subverting that, because we all are on our own paths, and we're very successful people. And so every day coming to work is a way to say I'm a success, and my academic career has not followed the 4 to 6 years in a PhD program, tenure track job, tenure now, churning out a book every couple of years kind of model. Mm-hmm. But I also feel like it's equally valid and important. The administrative stuff is also interesting. I've had a complicated relationship in my life with power and authority, as somebody who grew up working class, and sometimes working poor, and sometimes resisted authority figures, and went through a period of time where I thought I could never be in some sort of authority position, because it always felt like it had to be a top-down alliance with the rules and pushing rules on other people, and that makes me want to vomit. And then in my PhD program, I had a couple of mentors, the feminist rhetorician Joy Ritchie, and then my dissertation advisor and pedagogy theorist Debbie Minter, who were the dynamic duo of the chair and vice chair of our department. And like, they enacted this completely different way of being an administrator, where instead of your alliance being with the rules, your alliance being this like delicate balance between primarily the people that you're leading, with a dash of like institutional context and a dash of disciplinary expertise, and like trying to lead from that way. So like, how do I help maximize the potential of the people that I'm leading? How can it be about like forwarding the best selves of everybody in this unit? And that was really eye-opening, like, oh, you could be an administrator who is wholehearted and a good listener. Mm-hmm. And so I try to enact a narrative of administrator that's like that, that engages in deep listening of the people I work with. Mm-hmm. I think it is a delicate balance, and I don't know if I pull it off every day, but I feel like that's a kind of vigilante subverting. I think our institutions of higher learning could stay truer to the mission of education if more people in leadership roles would think of those roles in that way.
You're talking, I think, about engaging both your instructors and students and everyone else at every sort of level of the institution as people and as actors, mm-hmm. rather than as units to be moved.
Yes, absolutely.
And that is complicated, but especially at the size of the institution we're at.
Yeah.
Nonetheless.
Yeah. And I also think it's really important when you've got people, like, the moments when a leader needs to be listening most closely are when people are disagreeing. And like, I always like think I need to be open to the idea that I'm one perspective and I could be missing something. And the only way to check if I'm missing something is to be listening to others. And so that, yeah, that informs a lot of how I do my job. I really like it though. Like, works with some amazing people. So
I wanted to ask one more question about process, and both like your writing process, your revision process, but also how that, how you carve out time for yourself to do your writing when you have a very busy job as an administrator and teacher.
Did you hear the despair of that giggle? barely. I'm in a creative nonfiction group that we call ourselves the Sixth Chair, because there have been five long-standing, like 2-year long-standing members, and then there's been a rotating cast of characters filling the sixth chair in the group. But periodically it becomes apparent that I haven't turned in writing in a really long time, and then I agree to write something, and then it gets down to 3 days before we're supposed to meet, which is actually, it's, we're meeting on Tuesday, I have yet to, we're talking about my writing, and I have yet to complete my writing, so this is standard. And so that sets a fire under me, and I write something really fast, and then I go and I have really great conversations with my writing group colleagues, and then I revise. So it's like narrow windows.
You find that time crunch inspiring?
I don't think it's, I think it's terrifying, not so much inspiring. The times in between that, like, I write stuff in my head. And so that's when I commit things to paper. It's a tricky process. I think writing groups are, like I said, I'm also in an academic writing group where we meet and we write at the same time.
It's interesting because you work in a department full of very isolated writers. I mean, both at the faculty and grad student levels, I think there are people who very much work on individual projects and by themselves. And I think there's probably a lot of value toward thinking about it a little bit more collaboratively and communally.
As a grad student, I spent 4 years with 3 other grad students meeting weekly to discuss each other's writing. And I don't think I would have finished if it weren't for that core group of people. So I think everybody should be in more than one writing group.
Cool. I think that brings us about the end of our time. Our guest is Mandana Kinsey, lecturer in English and interim associate director of rhetoric, which just means that we expect a lot of her and don't pay her as much. And Dana's a wonderful person to have around in addition to that. So please join us for the next New Academy event on Friday, November 2nd from 3:45 to 4:30 or so in English Building 150. So please note that for this event, we're doing it a little bit differently than last time. There's a rhetoric instructor meeting from 2 to 3:30. So we're going right after that. We'll start at 3:45, and it's in room 150 in the English Building instead of the Literature and Languages Library. And thanks so much for being with us, Dana.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks. And thanks to John Claiborne for editing our podcast,
which is a new and wonderful wonderful development. Yes. This semester, so thank you. Thanks for being with us.